I remember associating in my mind that hard work does not equal resilient success.
He only knew, I don't want my son to go through the same thing. Doesn't matter how deeply financially stressed I get, yep, I have to give my son everything. We're the family that when we say we want to go to spring break, my dad would say, well, how about you load up the truck with car audio and drive down to Panama City and sell, wow, shit on the beach? Oh, that way your God. Trip is paid
it's free,
for.
Yeah.
I remember the first time we did it, we made $5,000.
God, dude, that is the best marketing I've ever heard in my life.
For 3 years, I buried my head in books. I was literally a 4.0 student. I didn't get an A minus on anything for 3 years.
Same.
Are you serious?
But I didn't study at all. That, you know what I did? Right.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the CEO Lawyer Podcast. Today, I'm with Bill Hauser, with the CEO and founder of SMB Team. And even though we have a bunch of digital marketing and content stuff that we talk about, today I want to go into Bill's story, because very few people at a young age can successfully build a multi-8-figure business and have a true company and a real infrastructure. So Bill, introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you.
Yeah, so my name is Bill Hauser, and I come from a bankrupt family with two parents who almost committed suicide. After the 2008 financial crisis, went through a terrible chain of events, I guess to say as an understatement, and chose to really probe into that and understand, like, why did my family's business crumble? And how was I going to do something different than what happened to my family's business in 2008? And decided to become obsessed with business, such as you.
What business was your family in?
Paving company.
Okay.
So my dad.
So paving company, 2008, and this is in Philly?
Yep, Philadelphia. And the most my dad ever did in a year was $2 million.
Top line?
Top line revenue. It's a low margin business, you know, paving. And 2008 hit, he depended on the Yellow Pages, and he basically saw all of his business dry up. And he did what any rational person would do. He stopped advertising. And that created this this negative cycle where all of his leads completely shut off. And we ended up going bankrupt. He ended up turning to the bottle, and we lost everything. Everything we owned got repossessed in a matter of 2 months. Everything, our house, our cars, we literally had to move into, we almost had nowhere to sleep. And I grew up as the, you know, decently well-off kid, right? And it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
So you were considered, like, growing up around your peers, elementary school, middle school, high school, you were considered, like, middle or upper middle class?
I would say, yeah, it was middle to upper middle class. The thing was, I grew up around a lot of poor people, so I was looked at as wealthy.
Yeah, you're the rich white kid.
Exactly.
Yeah, you look it too.
Yeah. So.
And so 2000, so when did everything start collapsing?
So it actually was collapsing a year before 2008, but my family didn't admit it. They wanted to be role models to me, so they kind of hid as much as they possibly could. And, you know, I remember one day we got, I drove up to the bank with my Ford F-150 black, small little pickup truck. And I drove up to the bank and I saw three people who worked at the bank when I pulled up, taking a video of me pulling into the bank parking lot. And the reason was because my dad kept telling me to park my truck on another street than where we lived because they were trying to repossess my truck. And then a few days later, they ended up repossessing my truck when I came home from school. It was crumbling way before 2008. It just took us some time to admit that.
What was your mom doing during that time? Was she working with your dad in the business? Or?
She was working in insurance. Her job was pretty steady throughout all of this. The problem was my dad was $1 million in debt and her income couldn't make up for that. And I grew up racing dirt bikes. I've broken 19 bones.
Wow.
So I broke my scapula, broken my upper humerus, 3 vertebrae in my back. I've had reconstructive knee surgery twice. I have, a lot more injuries than I'm proud of, because I grew up racing dirt bikes. And in the process of racing dirt bikes, as you can imagine, it's not like basketball, right? It's like, it's a very expensive sport. We have to travel all over the United States. Bikes break all the time, and that ran my family out of money.
You feel somewhat responsible for the bankruptcy?
Yeah, I do. And that was the reason that I suffered from anxiety disorder for, you know, 4 or 5 years after the bankruptcy.
How many, do you have any siblings?
Nope, only child.
So they wanted to give you the world?
They wanted to give me the world. And they my dad was in such turmoil with everything that had happened. He blamed me for a lot of it. I was in a band at one point in my life, and I wrote a song about how I wish I was a better son to my family, because I was convinced that I had caused this, that looking back, that made me a strong person, because that kind of mental struggle is what allowed me to cultivate my own belief systems, because I was so affected by thinking that I caused this. Because the reason my family went, my mom and dad got a divorce, a reason was because I walked in on my dad cheating on my mom. So I walked in on my dad while he was in a room with another woman that he said was a real estate investor, visiting for the weekend at our mountain house, and she was sleeping in a separate room. I woke up early in the morning, walked into his room, and they were butt naked, laying next to each other. And my dad told me, man code, you know, don't tell your mom this, you know.
How old were you?
I was 16. So I went home, and first thing I did is I broke down and told my mom. And then she had everything of my dad's on the lawn on the front lawn, all of his clothes, within 20 minutes of me telling her that.
What year was this?
This is, this is right around 2008.
Let's take it back one more generation. Do you know how your parents grew up? Did they grow up wealthy or middle class or like immigrants?
My dad was sexually abused as a kid, very intensely. He was beaten to a pulp by his dad every single day he came home from work. Every single day he came home from school, my dad had to wear at least 3 pairs of jeans on top of each other because he would get whipped so hard by his dad.
Yeah.
He got beaten to a bloody pulp, literally, in the shower one day when his dad was trying to catch him masturbating in the shower and punched a hole through the through the shower, and my dad got all this glass in his skin and is laying basically bloody from his dad trying to catch him.
Was his dad a drinker?
Bad. Yeah, really bad.
So it's almost like this perpetual cycle.
Yep.
The only difference is your dad was almost seeing it as a way out, because it's like, I want to be so far away from the type of person that his dad was.
Exactly.
And so he wanted to give you the entire world, but there's a disconnect there because he probably lacked the financial knowledge and business acumen to run a successful company.
Yep.
And then more importantly, he didn't have a good role model for a father.
Nope.
So he didn't know what a good father was.
Mm-hmm.
He only knew, I don't want my son to go through the same thing.
100%.
And so it doesn't matter how deeply financially stressed I get, I have to give my son everything.
Yep. Yeah, he was, my dad was amazing dad. Like he lived that script that you just said to a T. The problem is he did not deal with his childhood trauma. It was too painful to face. And eventually, I believe that pops up at some point in your life, which is why I ran towards psychotherapy when I was struggling. I ran towards, hiring a psychiatrist and a psychologist, because I wanted to become intellectually curious about stopping the cycle and understanding, what don't I know about myself here? What are the things I need to come to terms with? And that's why, for me, mindfulness is my center belief around equanimity in my life. Is I always come back to, like this morning, I meditated for 21 minutes this morning. It's a non-negotiable for me. Every single day, I have to see my thoughts objectively, welcome the present moment. I welcome everything that appears, whether I have an anxious thought, whether I have an exciting thought. I smirk at it like a kid crying, you know, like, oh, that's cool. I've seen that thought before. Oh, yeah, that's not affecting me. Oh, that's an exciting thought. I don't need to go chase that right now. And it's just this calmness around, I never want to run, because when I was originally overcoming anxiety, I ran from my fears. And that got 80% of my anxiety away. I'd turn on loud music whenever I was feeling anxious, distract. And then one point, when I got 80% of my anxiety away, I felt not happy. I felt not authentic. I felt like I wasn't at peace with myself.
You were so used to anxiety that normal felt abnormal.
Exactly. And then I had to really look at, what am I running from? Why would I still feel this way if I'm not anxious? And it's because I wasn't accepting what I loved. And my dad he was very, you know, blue collar kind of, he thought it was gay that I made smoothies in the morning. And one day, like, choked me in the kitchen because I made a smoothie in the morning.
Hardcore, old school.
Yeah,
you know,
you don't need that. You need eggs, man. Like, literally choked me for that. Like,
you know, do you forgive your parents?
Oh my God, yeah. I'm so grateful for my parents.
You know, we can't punish our parents or mistreat them because of the generation that they grew up and the lack of education mm-hmm. in that generation.
Yep.
So we have a duty as their children to learn from their mistakes, mm-hmm. but also understand that that's the best that they had.
Yeah.
And that's why I asked about your dad's relationship with his father, mm-hmm. because sometimes your parents are thrown into this situation mm-hmm. and they have no control over it. It's just the absolute best that they can do.
Mm-hmm.
So with my dad, it's interesting because he was the brilliant child of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And he came, and they were all living in the Middle East at the time in, like, you know, 60s, 70s,
mm-hmm.
fled the war in Palestine to go live in Dubai, the outskirts of Dubai. Ras El Khaimah is the name of the city. And when an opportunity came up to go to college, he, you know, took a student visa to come to the U.S. So he went to college in Atlanta, got his master's degree in engineering, mechanical engineering, in like 3 years. And it was his duty to bring all of his siblings over. There's 10 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the moment he graduated, started making some good money. He was living in Chicago, getting paid extremely well for, you know, if you're an immigrant and you come to the U.S. and you get paid a professional salary, mm-hmm. you have enough
That's
to live a great life
yeah.
and send money back home. And you're the king when you come back home.
Yep.
And so his dad wasn't around as much,
mm-hmm.
and it's almost like a cultural thing for old school Arabs
mm.
that the dad is not supposed to really be that involved.
Hmm.
It's almost like the dad is there to make money, and then that's it. And the mom is there to take care of all the children, take care of the house, and that's just the culture that you grew up in. And so there's this, in our new generation, this like co-parenting, like we're both responsible, like it's extremely uncommon.
Mm.
The problem that my dad faced, the catastrophe that he faced, was that his dad died when he was in his late 20s, after he, you know, finished graduating from mm-hmm. engineering school at Georgia Tech, and now all of a sudden he has to put his entire life on pause. Like, he
yeah.
was... like, the path was done,
mm-hmm.
right? You went through high school, you went through college, you got your master's degree, you're making money, enough
yep.
to send money back home. And now at like age 27, he has to stop everything and go back home to the Middle East because he has 10 siblings from like age 4 to 21
that he needs to take care of. And so he put his life on pause from like age 27 to 35 to be able just to like get these people and raise them and help them become, like a lot of it was just become civilized, and because they didn't have a father figure. So he became the father figure. And during that time, he's like, well, I got to start my life. Like, I'm going to get married and start a family. And he always held the responsibility to take care of his siblings to the point where I grew up working in a mechanic shop at like age 7, 8, and all the money that we made went to his family and his siblings. And it was the crutch for the entire family.
Wow.
That every one of Jamal's kids, my dad, every one of his kids, we're here to support the rest of the Awad generation, wherever they are in the world, because my dad took the responsibility of being the grandfather of the entire Awad family. And so that's why I always say I grew up with a 7-figure work ethic on a 3-figure budget, because I'd been working and I started having like these serious workplace injuries when I was in middle school, you know, like tires exploding in my face and like propane tanks falling on my foot and swelling up to the size of a rugby ball because I couldn't walk. And this was the way that we grew up, because it was too expensive to keep the boys at home. They'll just destroy the house and eat everything. So my dad would rather just take us to work, you know, put us to work. And I distinctly remember when I was like 8 years old, we only worked Monday through Saturday. And I was like, why are we? Because we were always broke. It's like, doesn't matter what we did, we were always behind. I'm like, why don't we work Sundays? And I said, how about me and Omar and Ibrahim, us three brothers, my Sam was my younger brother. We were only 11 months apart, but he was still like considered the baby. So I said, let's us three brothers go to the mechanic shop and work on Sundays. And whatever money we made, we'll split it 50-50 with my dad. So us three would kind of take our pot, and then he would get the other 50%. And then so like in week one, the first Sunday, I probably made like $20. The second weekend, it was like $62. The third week, it was like 100 plus. And at that point, my dad realized, I don't need to take 50%. We're opening up Sundays and I'm taking all of the money. And it made me realize that probably at an early age, even like inherently, my dad's not good at money management. So I started saving a lot of money. And when I was 13, I gave my dad $13,000 to finish renovating our house. And I saved that money from like plugging tires and changing wheels and doing car audio work on the weekends. That's kind of how I got that perception of money. And didn't matter how much money I gave my dad, it just evaporated because he didn't have the, you know, the money management skills. And he'd always have people in his ear. So when he'd have this pot of money, he'd think, well, my priority is going to lie with my family because I have to take care of them. And this continued to happen. I think at like age 17, I gave him another $15,000. And then finally, I just asked him, because he would consistently ask for money so that he can give to his family because they're always struggling. I'm like, Baba, this person that you plan on giving money to, is he the type of person that if you give him $1,000, he's going to come back with $10,000 in a year? Or is he the type of person that if you give him $1,000, they're going to come back a month later and ask for another $1,000? He said, definitely the latter. I said, okay, well, I am no longer responsible for the rest of our family. I have my own duty and obligation to start my life and do my thing, and I just cut it off right there. And by the time I was in college, I was running a multi-million dollar car audio business, and all the money was funneled to my dad. And I was, and the way that I was kind of making some extra cash on the side was I started eBay stores, and I would drop ship stuff online. I'd buy stuff from like auction websites and sell it. And I probably saved like 50 grand by the time I got to law school. And that's why I was able to, you know, work through law school and, you know, kind of build something. But I cut it all off completely. And I said, I'll give up the entire business because I want to build my own thing. And so I gave up this entire business. I gave it to my younger brother. Said, look, you take it over. I don't want to be involved anymore. I just want to focus on this new career. And so it's almost like a blank slate, but not really, because I had a lot of debt from this bad apartment complex deal that I made when I was in law school. And then also a little bit of law school debt. But in exchange, I had these years of business experience. During that time, I had an airbrush store that I ran. I was flipping cars on the side. Obviously, I did a little bit of real estate. I got really good at e-commerce. So I had a good pulse for how to make money, but I was just a salesperson, hustler. Like, dude, we're the family that when we say we want to go to spring break, like we're going to go to Panama City, my dad would say, well, how about you load up the truck with car audio and drive down to Panama City and sell shit on the beach. Oh, that way your trip is paid
free,
for.
Yeah.
And so, and we did that. I remember the first time we did it, we made $5,000, dude, all on train horns. We would, like people would pull up with F-150s and Dodge Rams. We'd be like, yo, you should get a train horn. And we'd install it right there on the beach. And it covered our costs for the hotel, for the entire stay. And we come back with a fat stack of cash. And that's how we, and the money would just go back to my dad when we got home. So you can imagine someone that's been in business and selling and working like hard manual labor for like 15 years. You give them a professional degree. You give me a doctorate in law and a master's in business. Dude, this shit is easy.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Way easier.
And I you know, I can't blame my dad for not having the financial, you know, resources and knowledge, because his dad wasn't there to teach him those things. And it was an entirely new system in America, you know? And he'd gotten ripped off so many times by other people. And that's why I think it's, you know, when you think about your childhood trauma and the experiences that you had, it's like, I'm thankful that I have those.
Yeah.
Like I get to use those as a way to make me unique and use that to further my life and for my family's life and for next generations.
Yep.
You know, but at the same time, you have a bigger obligation to become educated and know why those things happened.
Yep. And I think education comes best through action, right? And what's fascinating is I'm hearing you tell your story there, and I'm thinking, I saw how hard my dad worked. I mean, holy crap. I mean, and it was visceral. I could see how hard he worked, because he would come home and there would be tar under his fingernails and his hands would be black, and he'd fall asleep on the sofa with his hands literally like concreted in a deformed position. Because he didn't wash the concrete dust off of his hands, right? Like sleeping on his back, at coming home at 9 p.m., right? Waking up for a paving job at 6 a.m., closing every single estimate himself. He was the only salesperson for his business for 35 years. And I remember when everything crumbled, I remember associating in my mind that hard work does not equal resilient success, because I saw how hard he worked and his business wasn't resilient. And on the education front, I was so scared. My biggest fear is not knowing what I don't know. That is my biggest fear. And when I went to college, I was so scared of not knowing what I don't know. Out of fear, I almost didn't talk to anyone for 3 years. I did talk to people. But I buried...
You weren't that outgoing, like, you know, personality.
I was definitely outgoing.
Okay.
Yeah, I was in a band. I was...
So we'll just scratch that off the record.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to say is I buried my head in books for 3 years in school.
What'd you study?
I started studying engineering. I couldn't do it. I just couldn't think that way. And then I switched to business because I thought it was going to be easier to graduate with business. That was the level of my thinking at that point.
So you graduated with a business degree?
Yeah, I graduated with a risk management and insurance degree. That was my major, with a minor in finance and psychology. And the only reason I added those two minors is because I was afraid to graduate. So I needed to extend another year in college because I was afraid of the real world and getting like a real job. But I buried...
Was it a four-year program or five?
It was a four-year program, and I decided to go for a fifth year. And for 3 years, I buried my head in books. I was literally a 4.0 student. I didn't get an A- on anything for 3 years.
Same.
Are you serious?
Yeah. But I didn't study at all.
Oh, I studied
left. You know what I did?
Cheated.
I got an English degree. No, dude. I got an English degree.
I cheated.
And you know what I did was I went on collegeprofessors.com and I researched the easiest classes to take.
Yeah.
And then I reverse engineered on the course catalog what it was going to take to actually graduate and just coupled it with like some of the easiest classes. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that wasn't a great idea when I walked in one day to a class called Queer Theory. And I had no idea what they were talking about. And I just remember them explaining how Dracula has this like, it's a phallic symbol that their fangs are like penetrating their victims. And I'm like, what the fuck am I doing here? This is not an English degree, but 4.0. College was very easy. And I ended up studying abroad a lot when I was in college. So I lived in China for 2 summers. And then I lived in Mexico for another summer. Became fluent in Spanish, conversational in Chinese. Graduated magna cum laude or summa cum laude, whatever, and then had a minor in Spanish and Chinese because college was a joke for me. I just went there just for fun.
I would have never guessed that.
Yeah. I started pre-med.
That is so weird.
I was supposed to be a doctor. And then I remember I didn't become a doctor because my dad kept calling me a doctor. And the thing is, like, because my dad was an engineer, I'd always thought growing up that he wasn't a successful business person, or he wasn't successful in his career because he lacked the financial knowledge to manage his wealth. And so I associated the engineering degree with failure financially.
Yeah.
And as a result, I didn't want to do whatever my dad said, so I ran in the other direction.
Yeah.
I was like, dude, I'm just going to go to college because y'all want me to. And I was just it was easy for me. Like, I was a good student, and I never had to study. Like, I was the kid in law school that could read something one time, and all the kids hated me because it's like, I absorbed it. Like, let's go.
For me, that wasn't me. I had to read every paragraph. I had to read 3 or 4 times to even understand what it meant. Like, I was a very, very slow absorber of information. But have you ever, there's a book called Managing Oneself, and it's by Peter Drucker. And when I read this book, it changed my life because the book explained to me that there's different learning types. And in school, they force you into a learning type of read to learn or listen to lectures to learn.
Yeah.
And I learned very quickly that I'm an active learner. I learn through trial and error. And that is a actual learning type that Peter Drucker studied in executives. And when I read this, I also learned there's another learning type, which you and I both are. I talk to learn. I need to talk it out.
So true. Dude, I get smarter by talking about things.
Yeah. So this podcast benefits you more than the listeners in some cases.
Yeah, no, that's why I do it. It's like, and even when I'm teaching things to my team, you know, you learn best by teaching.
Yeah.
And I realized that early on. Like, I was just talking yesterday that whenever I have a new business idea, I talk to like the 50 smartest people that I know. And as I talk about it, the idea gets more and more fleshed out.
Yeah.
By the end of it, I have this like beautiful business plan, and then I just go and execute.
Yeah, it's a feeling of a roadmap in your head because you're able to form neural patterns by talking when you are a talk learner.
This, you know, someone just asked me this yesterday, asked if I was a visual learner. And I'm like, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah.
And I was looking at our old pictures of when I was in law school and how I'd color code everything. Mm-hmm. And I do have a big whiteboard everywhere I go. I love having a big whiteboard, but it's not because I'm learning that way. It's more like a visual representation of my plans. Mm. So I love big whiteboards specifically for organizational charts.
Yeah.
So if you see like CEO, director of operations, and you got CFO, CRO, CMO, and you have all these different branches, like, I love seeing that visually so I know the direction that my company's going.
Yep.
But I don't think I necessarily learned that way. I learned from talking about it and teaching it. So I guess I know what kind of learner I am. You just saved me all that time from reading the book.
Yeah, managing oneself, it's amazing. But to kind of finish the point on school, when I graduated, I felt this sinking feeling in my stomach that I made the wrong choice. And the reason that I chose risk management and insurance as a subset of business is because my mom was in insurance. And I immediately got a job at Chubb Insurance.
Yeah.
Huge, like, you know,
anytime
bureaucratic.
Chubb is on the defense side, you know you're going to get paid well.
Yeah.
Yeah, they pay so good on insurance claims.
So I was there, and I quit within 2 weeks.
This was age 22, 23?
Yeah, right when I, 22, yeah, when I graduated college. And I quit literally within 2 weeks. As soon as I got a stable job, I called my mom and said, I'm going to kill myself if I spend another day here. Like, this
Do you still talk to your dad?
Oh, yeah. I talked to him yesterday. Yeah.
And even, but like at that time, that age, were you still talking to your
not
dad?
Not really. No, not at that time. Yeah.
So when they separated, you were kind of more team mom because she didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not even that my dad did anything wrong. My dad was going through his own healing process.
He definitely did something wrong.
Yeah.
Like, you can't deny that.
Yeah.
And I've even said it publicly, like, it doesn't matter what kind of like financial success or what I build in my career. Mm-hmm. If I don't have my wife by my side my whole life, then mm-hmm. I've considered myself a failure.
Yeah.
And that's, again, also that it goes to lack of education.
Yeah.
He probably didn't realize how bad what he was doing, how awful it is.
Yeah.
You know, infidelity is the worst thing you can do to your spouse. Mm-hmm. But he probably was buried in all of the, his own psychological trauma and childhood
yeah.
danger that he experienced. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's, I mean, and it's okay to, it's okay for it to be bad because
yeah.
you learn from it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
So I didn't want to interrupt you because I really want to know how you ended up in digital marketing and why you got to the legal field.
Yeah.
But you're getting there. We got to Bill Houser, yeah. age 23, gentlemen, yeah. ladies and yeah. gentlemen. So,
So then at this point I quit, this job at Chubb, and I basically look to my left and right, and I'm basically, it was really interesting. I have this visceral experience, and I have all these funny jokes I do around my office now. You know, we have 72 full-time W-2 employees now, and I know you have a big team too.
Just out of curiosity, what did you want to be growing up, like career-wise?
Well, I wanted to be a professional dirt bike racer. That was my thing. And then I wanted to be in a big pop punk, you know, punk rock band.
You know what I wanted to be?
What?
An actor and a comedian.
Okay, yeah, I had that on my goals too.
Yeah, 100%. That's all I wanted to do. It's like I every time I watch someone acting or, you know, telling jokes.
I did Philadelphia. I did the Philadelphia Acting Academy for like 3 years, and I did stand up. I did stand up training, and I did improv training.
You think that's why you're so good at talking to people?
I think it's
because, you know, it's not natural. Like, not everyone is good, can just go on stage, capture people's
attention.
You have
that gift, too. I feel like more people have it than they admit to themselves.
No, I think I got it from talking to customers. Like, I got it from Mexicans coming in on Sunday afternoon to buy some rims for my shop, and
yeah.
I had to convince them and their family that it was a good financial decision.
For me.
And then when they pulled their truck on with a brand new set of wheels, I had to be so hyped to make them feel good about the purchase. So I got really good, and it got scary.
How old were you when you learned that skill or exercised that skill?
12.
Yeah, that wasn't it for me.
Yeah, 12. Yeah. Like, bro, from age 12 through 22,
yeah.
I put a dent in the Georgia market of wheels and tires. Yeah, and we'll talk about, like, how we built this incredible company.
Yeah.
Because we grew up in the 90s when car audio and wheels and tires were cool.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I always talk about is I started a graphics company, and what we did was, because electronics would go bad, mm-hmm. right? And people obviously wanted warranty. We created the company called Joker's Audio, and I came up with the slogan, clear as a bell, loud as hell. That's our slogan. And so it'd be like a little Joker head with Jokers on the top, audio on the bottom. And now it's still a company to this day. My younger brother runs it. But the deal was, if I put a Joker's Audio sticker on your car, for as long as you have that sticker, you have warranty on your product.
Oh my God, dude. That is the best marketing I've ever heard in my life.
And within a year, the entire town was flooded with Joker's Audio. And it was just a couple of young brothers in high school running the company. Like, we were,
bro.
And there's like 10, 15 different companies doing
this.
You know?
Oh,
so that
God.
Was the, and then I got so good. Like, people started wanting to buy these Joker's Audio stickers because it became a brand.
Yeah.
And so inherently, I started realizing the power of branding.
Yeah.
I'm like 13 years old. I buy a XY300P master plotter off eBay for $700 when I'm in like middle school, and I started just printing off stickers. I've done tens of thousands of these decals, and I don't know, call it fate, but I hired this one idiot who was supposed to like fix something on my computer, ended up deleting all of my files.
Wow.
Of all the graphics and vectorizations that I did for 7 years. And I just said, okay, well, I'm going to put that behind me. Time to move on. So I had all these like different experiences growing up in business. And that's why I feel like speaking on stage, talking on camera, selling, like all this stuff just kind of comes naturally.
Yeah.
But it doesn't sound like you had that experience.
Path. Yeah, so for me, I when I quit the job in insurance, I read the book, The 4-Hour Work Week.
Yeah.
Okay? Tim Ferriss sold me, to say the least. And so I thought, well, I'm going to create an info product business. I'm going to create an ebook.
Yeah.
And basically sell it at high ticket and learn internet marketing and blah, blah, blah. So I spent 8 months.
This is age 23.
Yeah, right when I quit the insurance job. I had no backup plan, no income.
This is funny because at that same time, I'm in law school and I'm in Cancun, Mexico at Grant Cardone's event.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and if you Google like Grant Cardone, Young Hustlers,
okay,
there's a video where I hustled him out of his watch. Like
no
in
way.
Cancun, like 10 years ago. It's hilarious. Oh, wow. But this is, because I'm trying to create this sort of image of our past.
Grant Cardone had a big impact on my life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's a sleazy salesman. He's obviously making money, but yeah. I don't know. I feel like I got to shower after I talk to him.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
But.
So, okay, 23, you quit Chubb. You started Info Product, right?
And
I studied digital marketing for 8 months.
No, that was the mistake.
Okay.
I spent 8 months writing a book called Worry 180 on how I overcame anxiety.
All right.
Okay? And I had this amazing experience overcoming anxiety after my family went bankrupt through college.
Yeah.
And so I decided I was going to change the world, and this still is a desire of mine. When I, at some point in my life, my vision is to help the world overcome anxiety.
That's your BHAG.
That is, yeah.
How do you plan to do that?
People. Through my gift, which is, speaking. So,
do you see yourself as kind of like heading in a Tony Robbins direction where instead of like business and stuff, you're going to kind of help people overcome anxiety and childhood trauma?
So, it's more of an interest. My life purpose is to inspire 1 billion people to upgrade their belief systems through my actions. So my vision is to become a billionaire by age 40 and to be worth $400 million by age 35, so by 2026.
Why is the number so important to you by a specific age?
Because I want to prove my vision is to prove to the public that you can set a goal and reach any goal that you set. And I don't want to have to even say it. My speaking should be, here's how I did it. I shouldn't have to tell theories. I should be able to just say, here's how I did it. Watch what I do.
You're so confident with the billion-dollar number at age 40 because you've gotten so good at the skill of doubling revenue every year?
Yes.
And you think that's going to continue at the 100 million mark, 200 million, 400 million mark?
I understand the difficulty of that, yeah. And I signed up for it. So, and hey, if I fail, great. I said it here, And you know,
well,
what's the
worst that happens? Think you're going to fail, but I think you're going to realize there are more important things than money, especially an arbitrary goal of $40 billion. You could do that way sooner.
Not
with
40
one,
billion.
40, at age 40, you make a billion.
Yeah.
But I think it's good that you have that financial goal and you have like a path towards it.
Yep.
But then there are certain things that change during that time. And I feel like I'm going to be a billionaire. It doesn't matter if it's at age 38 or 52.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to enjoy the ride.
Yeah.
And I'm very confident that I'm going to be a billionaire.
Yeah.
But the reframing started happening when I realized on my deathbed, especially experiencing my uncle who had... he was in a coma for like 5 years. Mm-hmm. So he was doing some outdoor work and a branch hit him on the head. And at that time he had been divorced and mm-hmm. his five children kind of estranged and he died alone.
Yeah.
Like by himself in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And I realized his whole life purpose was just to make as much money as possible.
Yep.
And I just thought like seeing that, and his name was Ali too.
Wow.
And so I saw that in front of my, like just right in front of my eyes. This guy's like just falling apart. His body is like almost decomposing. He'll have like these bed sores that are happening. He can only like lift one arm and like he has a piece of his skull that got removed. And it's not the same guy that I knew growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that like that pursuit of money can sometimes like jade you into thinking that is your value.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to think that way. I used to think that if you're not making a lot of money, you're not valuable to me. Mm-hmm. Like even your opinion doesn't really matter to me.
Yeah.
But then I got married and started having kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized the reason I'm making all this money now is to buy time for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I started taking mornings off.
Yeah.
Like 8 a.m. I go take my kid to school, go to the gym after, eat a good breakfast, come back home, chill with my wife, have a cup of coffee, and then go pick him up from his little daycare.
Yeah.
I'm starting my day at like 12 o'clock.
Wow.
And it makes me very efficient during the times that I'm working. But like my time is extremely valuable to me. And the thing is like I'm enjoying it.
You know,
like I'm enjoying it. So all I can tell you is that I know you're gonna be a billionaire. I'm very confident in that.
Same with you.
But I think life is gonna throw certain things your way. Whether that's with family emergencies or whether that's with higher purposes that you realize.
Mm-hmm.
And don't be so hard on yourself if that number needs to change. Because once you accept the fact that you're already a billionaire and it's going to happen, you get to enjoy the ride.
Yeah.
And you get to live in the moment all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to get into your story of how you went from insurance sales guy to building a digital marketing business to meeting Grant Cardone and being in rooms with some of the most influential people in the world.
Yep.
But I think now is a good time to stop and let people wait for part two when we come out with it, because now we've heard the Bill Houser story. Now we know why this guy is so freaking crazy genius. And now we want to see how it's manifested over the next few years. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in to the CEO Lawyer Podcast. I'm with Bill Houser from the SMB team. We will see y'all on the next one. Stay tuned.